Osiris.
Hey everyone, it's Cam Hurt, host of the Best Show Ever podcast, and we have got a second season coming out very soon that I am very excited about. We've got some very cool special guests, including musical acts that we all love, like Karina Reichman, Daniel Donato, Jake Brownstein from Eggy, Rick and Peter from Goose, and many more. Tune in for new episodes dropping on Osiris Media March 5th on the Best Show Ever podcast.
Starting out strong, are we? I'm on Dara. I am currently in Minneapolis. What I'm trying to do with my art? It's a good question. That's a deep question right there. I suppose there is something that I'm trying to do for myself, which is to fill some kind of spiritual gap that I perhaps lost. And so I think the pursuit of music is very much a spiritual path for me.
I saw the news the other night. There was a boy running into the light. When I get back, we'll analyze his sound.
All right. Once again, you are tuned in to the show on the road. I'm so glad you're here. My name is Zach Lupitan, and I'll be your spirit guide through the magical carpet ride of sound that we're going on this week. Ondara is our guest this week. He was born in Nairobi, and now he's in Minneapolis, creating this timeless, mystical, political, poetic, prophetic, roots pop Americana. Does it even matter anymore? I mean, who are we kidding? This music feels like it could exist in any time. But the thing that moved me most in this conversation is something that Ondara said later in our talk, that he had to create a new persona called the Spanish Villager simply to survive in his own body here in the United States. It has become commonplace, of course, to fear the immigrant, to portray them as a small, dangerous minority stealing our American way of life. But I have news for you. They are the American way of life. 84.8 million immigrants resided in the United States in 2021, and that was actually down by over a million because Trump was turning so many away. That's over a quarter of the population, and by 2065, they'll be 36% of the population. Ondara's music is the American dream as seen from a different perspective that maybe you haven't listened to in a while. And as he tells me later in the talk, as soon as he thought he might be giving up on the American experiment, seeing George Floyd killed in his adopted city of Minneapolis, well, something would bring him back to hoping again. And maybe it's knowing that there are people like Ondara creating the new face of America, creating the new art forms that we listen to, that we dance to, that we experience every day. These are the people, these are the immigrants making the more perfect union that America was meant to be. Now, just a heads up, I am holding my daughter July during this interview. Sometimes you have to do that as a dad when you interview your favorite songwriters. Your daughter has to come along for the ride. If you need a little of my band Dust Bowl Revival in your life this December, we're heading up the coast of California December 10th. We're playing at Morro Bay's The Siren, and then the 11th in San Francisco at The Chapel, then heading down to Joshua Tree's Pioneer Town Palace, yes, Pappy and Harriet's, on the 16th with the Eagle Rock Gospel Singers, and then finishing off the year at the Venice West here in LA for a holiday show with Ray Zaragoza. The Venice West, December 18th. It's going to be a lot of fun. As always, thank you so much for tuning in. If you like this show, leave us a kind review on the podcast page. It helps people find us, and share it with a friend. And if you happen to be in LA on Sundays, well, I have a new radio show, yes, on the real airwaves, folks. It's called the Sway Out West Radio Hour, KCSN 88.5, the SoCal Sound. Tune in 7 to 8 a.m. on Sundays. You might just hear some of our best interviews. Okay, that's it for me. Here he is now, Ondara. someone like you who came, you know, when you come from Minneapolis, from Kenya, with a love of the music of Bob Dylan and a lot of the folk music in America, I think there's a lot of expectations and hopes that maybe an artist like you would want to realize in our fractured United States. And you picked a unique time in our history to come here. How has the experience been in the last few years for you, seeing the United States wrestle with itself in front of the world stage?
Yeah, I appreciate that observation about the amount of demons that I was wrestling while making this record, because I think that's it's quite accurate. It feels like there's a lot of demons, and I was trying to slay them all at the same time. And I think at some point it became too overwhelming. Look now. The overwhelming speak of is certainly present, and I think at a particular point in the process of making this record, all of that became too overwhelming that I kind of dissociated from myself in some fashion, you know, and my sort of my body and my mind created this outside entity outside of myself to become some kind of repository for all the overwhelm and all the anxiety. In a roundabout way, maybe that answers the question you're asking about, or you know what America has been like.
It's a lot.
It's a lot. it's a lot. It's what you know. There was a particular point in the last few years when I think there was this kind of cultural decree, you could say, of the failure of the American experiment, right? Like I think like everyone had collectively agreed that this experiment is in fact an entire failure. I think being someone who kind of rearranged my entire life and to move here to essentially pursue that same experiment that's being decreed to be invalid was, you know, this sort of, it was a cognitive dissonance of sort. Right, where I felt like I was just like, wait, so if this thing is invalid, what am I doing here? Who am I and what am I supposed to be doing? Your parents felt vindicated, always found me a way. Must be the music thing, always called it the devil's spell. And I think that cognitive dissonance is one of the things that led to me dissociating somewhat and creating this other entity.
Well, you open the record with an alien in Minneapolis, and you could see the songs on this record unfolding sort of like the graphic novel that you are also creating of this character. And you wrestle with the identity of who you are and what you are in this space, right? Look what I've become, someone from another space and time. Look now what I've become, just anyone, no one, right? It's everyone and no one at the same time, which is what the immigrant experience really is in this country, right? We have the idea that America is to welcome everyone and to give the immigrant the true chance to succeed and live a better life, except it's often quite the opposite. And there's a fear of the immigrant, a fear of people with darker skin from other countries. And then you go to Minneapolis, which was the epicenter of the racial reckoning in this country, right?
I know. It's like when the universe hands you some cards, and it's almost funny in a way. It's comical how destiny unravels.
Well, when you come to this country and you're not a full citizen, right? Like you say in the song, you're an alien. That's what it says on your green card, right?
Yeah, it does say that.
It's almost like comical, right?
It is very comical.
You're from an outer space, you know, realm that we've never experienced before. You're an alien, right?
Yeah. I always thought that was a funny way of calling immigrants aliens. I always thought maybe it was a sort of slang or something, but then I saw it on my ID. I was like, well, this is not slang. This is you. This is just what they call you here. Which is very, very interesting. I feel like we should find a different word potentially.
Yeah, you think?
Yeah.
But I think there's something about this record and the way your voice is captured that I'm not sure if anyone's said this to you, or maybe they've said it to you a million times. It reminds me of the best work of Tracy Chapman in some way.
Right.
This sort of isolated but very intelligent soul that's observing the world going by, right? That you know exactly who you are in this space, but you don't know how everyone will react to you or treat you. Like, you know, you got to get out of there in that fast car.
Yeah.
You know?
You got a fast car. I got a plan to get us out of here. Been working at the convenience store. Managed to save just a little bit of money. Won't have to drive too far. Across the border and into the city. You and I can both get jobs and finally see what it means to be living.
Yeah. Like, there's something about her work and this work. I'm not sure why it reminds me so much, but that seed of pain and fear and trying to get through that and just being like, I'm going to be who I am in this space, even if people are afraid of me, even if the world doesn't know how to treat me. And maybe you have to be come this superhero otherworldly Spanish villager. Obviously you're not from Spain, but your name is shared by this town in Spain. How did you learn about that?
I was just randomly Googling myself.
As we do.
And then I was Googling Ondara, and then, you know, it's Google brings up this town, like a small village in the south of Spain. And I'm like, wait, what? What do you mean? I became very sort of obsessed with that. And I was trying to figure out how this very traditional African name from my tribe also happens to be the name of like an ancient village in Spain. And I tried to do some research. I asked my family. Nobody seems to know. It seems to be just some kind of mystery, I suppose. But that fascination with that sort of convergence of things is what brought up that moniker, the Spanish villager, some time ago, way before the character was even created.
Do you think you're going to make a pilgrimage one day?
I probably will this fall, because I have some shows in Spain. In Barcelona and Madrid, and I was thinking I might just pop by Ondara before the Barcelona show and see what that's about. Just
don't you know who I am? Like, you just like walk through the city gates.
Yeah, right. Like, I own this town.
It is I.
It is I. You live inside of me.
Do you feel that you've become accidentally or not an American since you've been here? Is there something about being here that has changed you?
Sure. I mean, in some ways. I mean, I was toying with some titles for my upcoming tour, and one of the titles which I passed by was the De-Americanization Tour. And then I thought that might be slightly incendiary for somebody, and I decided not to. I do feel like there are some aspects of me that have been slightly Americanized. Certainly in just the vigor and the hunger in the pursuit of the American dream, right? I think that sort of the drudgery of it. You know, I think there is a certain kind of a, at least the way the cultural perspective about this pursuit of the American dream seems to me as to be this sort of like a rat race of sort that would eventually almost certainly lead to a fatigue of the spirit and of the body. And I got into this sort of just rat race of like, what's the next thing I can do? What's the next thing I can do? As I, that's one aspect of myself that I'm trying to de-Americanize from with this new record and with this new path of SV is to be more conscious about my spiritual health and my mental health, to prioritize those things as opposed to, you know, profit and land and, you know, the sort of traditional framework of the pursuit of the American dream. Yeah.
Well, it's like the only people who really know what the American dream really means these days are the first generation immigrants, right?
The pendulum tells, the government shifts. It's just a new face in the same old abyss. The pendulum tells, the government shifts. It's just a new face in the same old abyss.
But the song A Prophet of Doom, for example, right? You have this line that kind of keeps cutting through. Democracy on the line. Democracy on the line.
Yeah.
JJ also likes democracy, apparently.
Yeah.
And especially since January 6th, it feels like democracy is in the balance right now. You know, the thing that has made this country really the greatest democracy in history is that we believe in the peaceful transfer of power, right? If you lose, you step down every time, not just some of the time. Mm-hmm. And you could see how the cracks in that system have started to form, right? And you had a coup that almost happened, but some people still stood up for what was the right thing to do. And the question is, if that starts to happen again, right, what will we do about it? The citizens, the people who are observing from the outskirts, you know, what is the artist's responsibility in a possibly crumbling democracy? Do we have a responsibility?
I think so. I think it's being a sort of a observing and chronicling, so to speak. Which it sounds somewhat, you know, not the most bold thing. I suppose there is the warrior goes to battle, and then the artist observes the battle and paints it, so that the future generations can potentially be aware of the perils of war. But, you know, I think, you know, our work, or at least I think one important role of art in general is for art to be some kind of mirror of the society, right? Like a way that we can reflect upon ourselves. Because I think there's times when we're just sort of on autopilot. In a way, we're just doing things, falling into the grooves that we've created in our minds, and we're just, you know, what's the immediate incentive to feed. And I think what art does, in a way, is it interrupts that, and it creates like a mirror of sort, such that when you see yourself through a mirror and see the things you do subconsciously, hopefully you can do something about it. You can make a change. So I think the role of art is to observe and to chronicle and to, you know, to paint what we're seeing, and to do it loudly enough in the hopes that it, you know, it sort of pierces through culture somehow.
Well, you consider yourself almost a kind of musical journalist, right? I mean, that's sort of how this is presented. The cover, it has this newspaper like quality, right?
And absolutely, yeah.
But that line in A Prophet of Doom, democracy on the line, look at me, I don't seem to mind, put your feet under the blanket and watch it all burning down.
Yeah.
It's like we are so distracted by our everyday lives and from the fear of what could come, that I think it's easy to want everyone else to take care of the work of democracy, right? Yeah. Oh, someone else will go vote and figure out all these local elections and I don't have to worry about that. But it's like, this is how these threads of evil start to get stitched together, because the people who want abortion to be overturned, you know, Roe v. Wade to be overturned, they've been working at that behind the scenes for 40 years, right?
Right.
And we've got our feet under the blanket. We're like, it's never going to happen. And then it does.
Yeah. What's that thing about the only thing that what's needed for evil to survive is for good people to do nothing? Is that like some kind of saying like that? Paraphrasing.
Yeah, I think it's from the Holocaust, maybe. Yeah.
Is it? Yeah. But yeah, absolutely. And I think I also read the same thing from that line, where there's some kind of a weird resignation, where, you know, I think we expect, well, you know, my friend will worry about democracy, or, you know, whatever is the most pressing issue in culture at a particular time. I think we forget that it is our responsibility, right? That it is you and me.
And then, like, in a seasonal amnesia, right? It's like we need that savior, right? It's like we're hoping for some higher power to sort of do the work for us, or to kind of like make things easier. And then that amnesia for me feels like the blanket of indifference to do anything new to change things, right? It's like, well, we can't change the past. It's just going to keep building upon itself until it's too late. You know, what does that song mean to you?
I mean, I think there is I can follow your interpretation. I agree with it as well. I think I would maybe extrapolate on that and to bring up the point of just how we tend to forget the past. I think this is connected to what you're saying as well, but we tend to sort of, we have some kind of amnesia. We forget somewhat of the our previous mistakes, you know, the things we've done in history. And like, no, you know, we'll never do that again. Like, you know, we've grown beyond that. And then history tends to just repeat itself. And so I think that's in essence what I get out of it. It's just this idea of having an amnesia of the past. Like, you know, you just moving, you know, not being very cognizant that we can make those people that lived in the past and made those, you know, abhorrent errors that we like to pine about were humans like us, and we have the capacity for all of that within us, and it's helpful to be conscious of that so that we can move forward.
What was your life like in Kenya before you came here?
It was, I suppose when I think about it now, in retrospect, it feels like it was probably hard living in, you know, in poverty, struggling to get by. But at the time it was just life. It was all I knew. You know, it was just, that's what life was. When I think about it in retrospect, there's just this, after being here for a while, like, well, that must have been hard. But you know, it didn't really feel too particularly hard at the time. I was just, it was different. It wasn't, we didn't have too many luxuries. We grew up living in the slums and all of that stuff. But life was just life. That's all we knew at the time. I was happy for what I remember, other than desiring to create art, having no kind of support system for that. That was the hardest thing about growing up back there.
Do you think you'll ever do a tour of certain countries in Africa with this music?
I would love to. Yeah, I think. Yeah, absolutely. I think I have to too. You know, certainly this record. I think I would love to go back at some point and play some shows back there with. Definitely in Nairobi, but you know, there's places that I would love to play too, like South Africa and places in West Africa and North Africa too. So it's definitely in my to-do list for sure to plan out some shows back there.
I mean, being nominated for a Grammy for your first record is a pretty magical turn of events for any musician, right? Did you feel like it was the best thing that ever happened to you, or something that was almost like too much too soon, like you hit a grand slam on your first at bat in a baseball game or something? Sure. Like so much to live up to, because now it's like, what are you going to do on every other record?
Yeah, right. Well, a lot of things were happening very quickly at the time, and I didn't have enough time to process all of it while it was happening. You know, the pursuit of art is certainly not about that for me. You know, it's something larger than that, but I'm also grateful if people are appreciating it in that fashion as well.
I mean, you have songs, you know, on that record, Tales of America, like Lebanon, that have been listened to 15, 20 million times, right? I mean, that's a pretty amazing feat for what would be considered a folk song. And there feels like a very, again, a spiritual vein going through that song. In the water, the fire, I'll go wherever you go, in the valley and the canyons, I'll go wherever you go. It feels like a hymn, right? That's something you'd sing, yeah, in church, you know. Do you see a particular higher power when you sing a song like that, or is it something much more inside of you?
I don't think I was referring to any particular higher power. Although I am generally a fairly spiritual person. You know, I think about it as it's a service. I'm a conduit for the sorrows of the universe. In a way. And so, you know, you could call the universe a higher power. There is certainly something higher that art serves, you know. There is something that, you know, like, I don't think art serves commerce. I think art serves something else, something larger, you know, something bigger. And that's the only thing that art should yield to, not commerce. So, you know, I believe in that at my core, and that's why the pursuit of art is very much a spiritual experience, and all of that, I think, comes out in the songs in one way, in some ways or another.
When you sing American Dream off that Tales of America record, do you see an ideal version of yourself 10, 15 years from now, like achieving some sort of part of that dream? Or is it almost a utopian impossibility? That's like the very nature of that idea of an American dream.
Well, I think for me, I'm trying to somewhat deconstruct what the culture perceives that idea for myself. Which is a big part of the SV trajectory, is there is something that I see in 15 years, but it's not something material. It's more like a frame of mind. It's like, you know, I want to see myself as very fulfilled and very very happy, very joyful, very content with life and with where everything is. So it's a frame of mind. It's not tied to anything overly material. And I think initially it was certainly while I was sort of plugging into the operating system of American culture, where I was like, go this, go grab that. And then at some point I felt like that was just fatiguing my spirit at a very fundamental level. And I was like, this isn't sustainable. I need to, you know, sort of restructure what I think the American dream is, what I want it to be for me. And for me, that is just, you know, achieving this place of joy and equilibrium.
And the ghost from the river is watching. She won't let you get any close. He was just an American dream. He was just an American dream.
You bring up these different tokens, I think, of American myth, right? The gun, the sword, yeah. Gold, silver,
sure.
The idea of hallelujah, that sort of spiritual awakening that I think a lot of people in this country feel like, you know, it's up to us to spread the Christian beliefs of the American mighty power around the world.
Sure.
And it's dangerous. It feels even more dangerous today when you see so many young people, especially, getting killed from gun violence only in America, right?
Yeah.
And the idea that we have no way of stopping it, that we have this connection between people who are very devout, you know, tied to the church, and the need to be a heavily armed militia in your own home or something. You know, it's a very uniquely toxic American thing. JJ agrees. And I think that it's up to the artist and the writer, the journalist, to start to poke holes in those myths and say, why do we have to be this? Do we have to be this?
Absolutely.
There's no catching your breath. There's no rest till you're dead. There's no heaven or hell. There's no running away.
Asking the question, do we have to be like this? And I think that's a big part of what art is meant to do. And I think, you know, it's a big part of what I think my mission is, part of the what I'm meant to do, is to poke all these holes as an outsider and paint this picture of America and ask people to look at themselves, you know, from that portrait. You know, it's like someone painting you while you're in your house and, you know, showing you that picture. I'm like, this is what you do. Do you like what you do? Kind of thing. Yeah.
The record Folk and Roll Volume 1, Tales of Isolation, which came out in 2020. It's funny because that cover that you have, it's like you're bursting out of this door with your guitar. Like,
yeah.
Like it's a weapon. Like, I'm coming out. Yeah. Is it okay?
That's essentially what was happening there, because he was like,
a lot of us felt like that in 2020. How did you get through the darkest days of those you know, first few shutdown months? Like, what were you feeling in those times?
Yeah, that was a dark period for me. I guess it was a dark period for everyone. But yeah, I came from like this massive tour with the Lumineers to like having to be indoors for months. And I think this record in a way is what took me through that period, because I made it in maybe 3 days. You know, I was in this period where I just was in a bit of a rut and I didn't know how to get out of it. And then I woke up one morning and I just essentially vomited all these songs. And then I spent 3 days recording them in a friend's living room. You know, I wanted it to sound very raw, very sort of like Nebraska, like the Springsteen record. And you know, that making that record and playing it every day was really, I think, my point of salvation. I don't know how I would have gone if I didn't have that.
License registration, I ain't got none, but I got a clear conscience about the things that I've done. Mr. State Trooper, please don't stop me. Please don't stop me. Please don't stop me.
What is your favorite, like, first date activity?
If you first date
romance someone, like, what would you do?
Take them to a gun range. I'm just kidding.
America.
I don't know. I mean, I sort of, I think I'm concerts seem are always safe, you know. A concert
if
is
the music's
safe.
Good.
What's that? If the music is good, yeah.
If the music
yeah.
is good.
Sure.
Hey, do you want to go to this death metal concert with me? You're going to love it.
Yeah. Just trying to talk over like loud mathematical guitars. Concerts always feel safe. It's like a safe environment to know someone and, you know, chat with them. But also there's concerts where you want to go and like watch the show and not talk to someone. So between that and something simple like tea.
The song A Blackout in Paris, I think, is my favorite track on this new record.
Oh, is it?
And it really... I saw that you were inspired by, you know, Fleetwood Mac's Rumors, you know, it felt like something that could be on 70s AM radio, just very groovy, you know, even though, you know, the lyrics are pretty dark.
Pretty dark, yeah.
But that's what makes Rumors so great, right?
Yeah.
It feels like this sort of summer love song record, except that it's about all these people sleeping with each other and it all falling apart, right?
Yeah.
And you have that line, are you new in the city? Haven't you heard the plagues coming round? There was one and then many riding dragons into town, right? That, you know, we're trying to survive, again, all these demons and threats coming at us from every direction.
Yeah. It does feel like we've just gone through some kind of plague, doesn't it? The plague of COVID. I think that line, when I think of it now, I imagine sort of like someone walking into like a city, or maybe like walking into a restaurant in the middle of like 2020, or maybe like early 2021, when people are still wearing masks, and you know, someone just like walks in and there's no mask on. It's like, you know, are you new? Haven't you heard? There's a plague in town. That's definitely not what I was thinking about when I wrote it, because that's a much older song. While you're waiting for your lover to come around, while you're waiting for your lover to come around, everyone you ever knew is escaping town. While you're waiting for your lover to come around. It's an oasis, go read the data. All of the masses have departed. Who's the market's gone while you?
Do you ever feel like giving up on the American experiment? Is there any time where you feel like, I just don't know if I belong here, if this is okay for me? Or does it feel like the hope transcends the fear?
I mean, I've definitely had many, many moments of giving up, sure. Especially in the last few years. I've come pretty close, but I feel like the work isn't done yet. You know, I feel like I haven't accomplished the mission. The prophecy is ongoing. I think I am a child of destiny, in that it's only by luck of the universe, you could say, that I found myself in America. So I am in pursuit of some kind of destiny. I feel like it would be somewhat careless to give up, even though I've come very close many times and wondered if this place is for me at all, many times. And I always find a way to calibrate into hope and keep a positive attitude and put the best foot forward. Coming back to the center, finding my center in a sense that I'm not trying to get anything as much as I'm coming back to me and to my body and have everything emanate from there. You know, I think that that's a less fatiguing way of pursuing the American dream, right? Where you centralize within yourself and your body, and then you leave from there, and then the things that are meant to be yours come to you. The things that are not, they'll move away, as opposed to this sort of like mentality of like, you know, what can I do every hour of every day to maximize my profit?
In many ways, this record, it feels like a travelogue, right? We have Berlin, we have Tokyo, we have Paris, we have Minneapolis. Is there one city in the world, if you were to pack all your bags and move everything and live somewhere else, where you could like create a new life, where would that city be?
Oh, probably Paris. I love spending time in Paris. That might be it. Paris, yeah. It's an easy choice, but you know, there's still a lot of the world that I haven't seen. I do like most of the world. I like Minneapolis a lot, and I like LA, New York.
I think there's a song where you mentioned like Cincinnati. I was like, I don't think Cincinnati gets a lot of love in most folk music.
Yeah. Ohio, man. I like it from Cincinnati, Columbus, Ohio, and Cincinnati, Ohio. Yeah.
In your journey as an artist over the last few years, is there a particular show that sticks out in your mind as like your big rock star moment where you're like, I can't believe this is happening?
The song A Blackout in Paris, so it's that title. The first time I happened upon it was on my last concert in Paris, where there was a blackout. The lights went out the whole block. And so for about, you know, 20 minutes of the set, I had to play unplugged acoustic, and it was a fairly big room too. So it's a memory that it's hard to forget, you know, that kind of thing, where it's like you're in a darkness with a crowd and you're playing unplugged, and the crowd is helping you along and putting their phones up and all that. It was a cool moment, sure. That's certainly one of the most meaningful moments in music that I've had. And you know, there's other things like, you know, tours with Neil Young and Lindsey Buckingham and things like that. They were also very like, whoa, this is wild. But the things that stick the most are those little moments, right? Like that moment in Paris, or like a long letter from a listener who's been affected positively by the music. I think those are the things that mean more to me, more than playing with big artists or getting accolades or whatever. It's just making that very raw connection with people at the ground.
Did you get to speak at all and hang out at all with guys like Neil Young and Lindsey Buckingham. I know, like, their reputation is that they're a bit salty. But yeah, yeah. I don't know. Maybe you saw a different side.
I mean, I guess I spoke to them a bit, not too long. Just a trading of pleasantries, you could say. nothing too detailed. Probably spoke more with Lindsey than with Neil. One of the greatest lessons I took from those tours was just watching these guys were, you know, a lot older, obviously, but they walk into the stage every night and it's like they're in their 20s and they're doing it the first time, right? And seeing that every night was very, very spectacular to watch, and it's something that I hope to carry on into my later years in this work.
If you could harness the Spanish villagers' supreme powers,
sure,
and create a tour with five artists, including living or dead, who would you put on that tour?
Whoa, that's a great question. That's such a wild question. I mean, Bowie for starters, definitely. I am going through a bit of a Bowie phase, I think. You know, he did this thing where he, like, you know, he became Ziggy for a bit, right? I don't know what his reasons were. For me, there's a lot of survival that has gone into, you know, like SV is kind of a survival mechanism. I had to create him to just continue to live. I wonder if Bowie's reasons are more artistic. I think the art for me is sort of like almost, at least in this particular project, it looks artsy and cool, but that's not the origin of it. I wasn't trying to create cool art. I was just trying to survive, and that came out the way it did. I think Bowie would be top, high up on that list for sure, because of that similarity of trying to adapt a character. I want to say Coltrane. So I'm also in a bit of a Coltrane phase at the moment. Something about making music more professionally has made me want to listen to more instrumental music. For some reason, I've become more wary of, like, I want to keep my sort of thread well of lyricism pure in some fashion. I don't know if there's something somewhat juvenile about that, but I have been listening to a lot more instrumental stuff, and I love Supreme has become a, you know, sort of go-to record for most days, and I'm looking forward to a time where I can do a tour and have like a sick jazz band open the show. I think that would be really, it would be really cool. So definitely put Coltrane there. I would put Dylan most places, just because, you know, because it's sort of like the...
Which
the
album of Dylan? He has to play one album in that time. Like, you can get 1968 Dylan.
Sure.
which Dylan?
I would get like Highway 61 Dylan, right?
All right.
This is the moment when Dylan becomes, you know, like, it's like the big rock record. It has like a Rolling Stone in it. I think it's that would have been a lovely time to see Dylan, you know. And also, he's also wading through this period of backlash from like the folk community, and so there is that kind of the idea of making a turn, an artistic turn that maybe alienates some people. That was Dylan certainly when he was doing the electric thing. It was definitely Bowie when he was deciding to do this thing with Ziggy. It's certainly me at present with the SV trajectory, and I think it's the idea of being true to yourself and being true to to your muse, whether people get it or not, is something admirable. And yeah, how many did I name so far?
All right, we got Dylan, we got Bowie, we got Coltrane.
Ah, okay, so two more. I want to say Stevie.
Wonder or Nix?
I was thinking Stevie Nicks. Yeah, but Stevie Wonder would be really cool too.
We could just finish the last two with both, yeah, Stevies.
Right. You know. Both Stevies, yeah.
Double Stevie. Stevie on Stevie, the closing act.
Yeah. Yeah, that's quite a question though. It's made me think a lot about the record and about myself.
Let's take it out with a contrarian odyssey, because I think as maybe people who discovered you a few years ago are now learning, right?
Yeah.
The acoustic folk singer identity is not going to hold you back any longer, right?
Right.
That song feels like it could be a U2 song, right? Like it feels like you got these pounding drums and that spare edge guitar coming in, you know?
Yeah.
You know, you're talking about, again, some very deep spiritual stuff. You talk about the Torah.
Yeah. Yeah. Bringing the Torah.
Not something that folks are usually putting in rock and roll songs.
Yeah, you know? That's not. Yeah. That's definitely one of my favorite songs in the record. It's very, I dance to that. I love dancing to that. It's very groovy. I can certainly see some U2 in there somewhere. I was indulging in a bit of Joshua Tree while making this record. There's a bit of that, I think, scattered in the record in places. You could probably hear it too in the beginning of Alien. You know, there's that sort of intro. It's very Joshua Tree like. But anyway, yeah, so there's a bit of that influence there. Maybe since it's the last song in the record, maybe it's pointing to the future as well, in a way, as to what's potentially coming. But it's very heavily themed, you know, speaking about the Torah and
Holy waiting on a forgotten answer. I think that's like the line that sticks out for me, you know. Waiting, yeah, on a forgotten answer. Aren't we all doing that right now?
Yeah. That's a good line.
Forgot like about. we know what it is that I think will make us better people, a better society, and yet we forgot what that answer is somehow, you know.
Yeah. I wonder if that ties back into like amnesia in a way. The song we were previously discussing before. It's, you know, We're waiting on something we forgot, you know, because we've forgotten who we are.
Well, if you ever come through LA again, please look me up. You know, we should go jump in the ocean together.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for the chat. Thanks for
the
in-depth look into the whole journey. It was good talking. Thank you for having me. I'm bringing the Torah. Yeah.
There he goes. Big thanks to Ondara for talking to me. You can go to SpanishVillager.com for his tour dates and his newest record, Spanish Villager Number 3. Looks like he'll be playing some sweet shows in Spain, in the United Kingdom, in France, in the Netherlands. Please go see him live. I really can't wait to see him in LA when he comes back. Back on November 3rd, you could actually hear Ondara on another podcast on the Bluegrass Situation Network. Basic Folk recorded him, and they talk about his childhood in Nairobi and so much more. Please listen to Basic Folk. It's a great show. As always, the show on the road is written, produced, and edited by yours truly, Zach Lupitin, and we are a part of that BGS podcast network. If you can, leave us a review about how rad this show is or how not rad it is on our podcast page, and you can see videos of this show on our YouTube page as well. We have some really cool episodes coming up, including next week when I talk to Adrian Casada of Black Pumas. If there's an artist, a songwriter that I must talk to that I'm not thinking of, well, send an email to showontheroadpod@gmail.com. I'll leave you there. Stay safe, stay creative, and we'll see you next week out on the trail.
Hello, Tom May here, host of Future Friday. I've spent the last 15 years on the road with my band, The Menzingers, where I've met all kinds of wild and fascinating people. So I started a podcast. On Future Friday, I talk to fellow musicians about the moments that made them, their passions outside of music, and the curiosities that tie us all together. I've also talked to the likes of UFO researchers, magicians, soldiers, and documentary filmmakers, and I'm constantly searching for folks that can shape and change our view of the world. You can check out Future Friday wherever you like.